Welcome. Welcome to Radio Economica this Thursday morning. We are very honored and happy to have with us Jorge Valero, EU correspondent. Good morning, Mr. Valero.
Hello, good morning.
Yes, you have come to speak about something which actually took place in Brussels yesterday, which was a meeting of the Eurogroup and actually an election of, what is it, the chair, the president of the Eurogroup. Could you tell us a little bit what happened yesterday? Because this is really fresh from the press.
Yes, exactly. Yesterday it was the election of the Eurogroup president. We will enter into details now, but basically the winner of the election was the Irish finance minister, Pascal Donoghue, who was the one who gathered enough votes, a simple majority, among the 19 finance ministers of the euro area. So that means that he convinced 10 of his colleagues to support him. His rivals were the Spanish finance minister, economic affairs minister, Nadia Calviño, who passed the final round against him, and the third contender, who was eliminated in a previous round, was the Luxembourgish finance minister, Pierre Gamino. And of course, there are many implications, many readings, and many outcomes of this election that we will talk about now. But briefly, we could say that this was Donoghue versus Calviño. It was somehow an election or a clash between the North and the South, between the EPP family and the Socialist family, between small countries and big countries, between men and women. But if Calviño would have won, it would have become the first female president of the Eurogroup. And
something
we could
quite
say,
new.
Yeah, certainly, and that will have happened just 1 year after, exactly 1 year after Lagarde and von der Leyen became presidents of the Commission and the ECB for the first time. I mean, so the Calviño election will have represented another step forward, breaking the glass ceiling for women among the top posts in the EU. I think an interesting reading of the outcome of the election was the rebellion of the smaller member states. This could sound as something controversial. But this comment that I discussed with other colleagues on Twitter doesn't mean, or is not a comment on in terms of the representativeness of bigger states or smaller states, whether Germany, France, Italy, and Spain have bigger weight to have bigger voice for being bigger. No, it's not that. But when you spoke with diplomats and EU officials over the past days, what they told you is that having the support of the bigger economists, as it was the case of Calviño, could play in her favor at the end, in the very last minute, to, let's say, try to gain in this couple of votes that she still needed. But at the end, that was not the case, and we will explain now more why. And Donoghue was the winner. And he will take over from the outgoing Eurogroup president, Mario Centeno, on the 13th of July, so next week.
That's soon enough. Now, could you tell us again, please, because we're talking about presidency, we're talking about the Eurogroup, which is, as far as I understand, an informal group. Some people talk about the club, but that's probably controversial. From an institutional point of view,
actually, we have to say that those people who call it a club, they are closer to the reality than those who might describe it as a proper institution, because there are no proper rules. The Eurogroup started as a gentleman's club of those who were joining the Eurozone to sort of coordinate the policies and decisions of the Euro area members. But in fact, when you have to take a decision at Eurogroup level, you have to sanction it, you have to ratify it at the ECOFIN level. The election of the president is detailed in a protocol. So there are not like a, there is not like a treaty or something stipulating or setting up the Eurogroup as a proper body. So yes, and it's a very secretive institution that usually works by consensus. That's why the whole process of the electing his president is also, I mean, the rounds of votes, which are also, I mean, secret. Even the candidates don't know who finally support them. It's designed in a way to try to protect the consensus. But I mean, at the end, of course, I mean, you have these divisions that have been there since the bailout period in 2010. During the process and the debate of the Eurozone reform, we have seen a lot of blame game between other countries and southern countries during this coronavirus crisis.
So these divisions go back to the sequel of the financial crisis, if I understand rightly. So they are finance ministers, very much an all-male body. And now we have a small country, Ireland, which is what? In between in between groups?
Not really. I mean, Ireland, it's a representative of this so-called Hanseatic League that includes Northern and Baltic member states and who were against the Eurozone, further integration, the deepening of the Eurozone that especially championed France, Spain with Calviño, Italy, Portugal, so let's say the Southern Bloc. Pascal Donohue, it's a very senior member of the EPP family among the finance ministers. There is a clear fracture there or between northern and southern countries. When you asked yesterday, I did that to Mr. Donohue, whether he was concerned about how this fracture could affect his work for the next 2.5 years. He said that he was very optimistic about his ability to build a very inclusive view within the Eurogroup to work, to progress forward. And he could work with, and he was also very optimistic about how he could work with all his colleagues. It's true that not every EPP member or every Southern member voted for their blocs. So there were some, let's say, votes that were, let's say, changing sides. But overall or in general, we could say that there was a voting discipline along the blocs and the political families.
Okay, so, what do you think is to be expected from this particular profile of the new Eurogroup president? I mean, in a week's time, there will be a European summit.
Exactly. So the implications of having Donohue as the Eurogroup president are seven. I mean, as you said, the first and most immediate one is how his election will impact the process of agreeing on the recovery fund, which the leaders will try to hammer out next weekend. And this is his absolute priority. I mean, try to contribute, try to help to facilitate an agreement among the member states. Some people said that having a president, Eurogroup president from northern countries will make things more complex for those who are calling for more ambitious, for a more ambitious response, because somehow this show the strength and the unity of the Northern Bloc, and also how Donoghue could play his part in, let's say, maybe imposing tough conditions or some issues like that. Some others' voices also suggest that maybe there could be some sort of compromise, and because the Northern Bloc got disposed, they will ease a bit their opposition in regards to some of the stumbling blocks that, in regards to the recovery fund and the EU budget. It remains to be seen. But I think that all in all, the clear conclusion is that the northern countries came out as the winners. They came out united, and I think that their voice is gonna be heard, despite that the rest of those who are calling for a more ambitious response, those who were supporting Calviño, represent 80%, at least 80% of the EU Eurozone GDP, which is the case of Italy, France, Spain, and Germany. And another implication is another issue to look at is how his election will affect two issues that will be on the very top of the agenda over the next months and couple of years, which is the stability and growth package review, and first of all, actually, the reactivation of the fiscal rules, and secondly, the tax issues, because we all know what is the tax regime in Ireland. We also know that actually Ireland was among the four countries against the digital tax. Tax is going to be a priority over the next years, not only to finance the recovery fund, but also because the member states are pushing a lot to harmonize the tax regimes and to fight against tax erosion in the EU. And also the digital tax is going to be a very thorny issue and a very important issue the next year once, most likely, the OECD is not going to be capable of forging an agreement at international level. So the EU will try to put forward a proposal for a second time to reach an agreement among the member states.
The question is, which countries do you find in the Northern Bloc? I thought Ireland was on the southern side, but I may be wrong, obviously. What country? We are referring to, how was it, the sparing few or the sparing four, more or less the four Fuga countries? Fuga. They were not. Yes.
Yes. Ireland for sure. And among those Hanseatic members is not, the most staunch defender of, being a fiscal conservative country. And Ireland, in some issues, has been closer to southern positions. Ireland, we could say that it's a bit like Belgium, that on some issues has been closer to southern member states positions, but the country was part of this league, and it's not totally, it's not at the forefront or such a outspoken member of the Eurozone integration as Italy, Spain, or France could be. It's somehow a mediator, and precisely this is the reason why some of Donoghue's defenders said that he could play a better role as a Eurogroup president to try to heal all these divisions and fractures and tensions over the past years, precisely because of that, and because Calviño was perceived as a Eurogroup president, was a minister who was very outspoken on economic matters and fiscal matters, because he was very much in favor of the Eurozone budgets. He was very much in favor of the, for example, the unemployment, European unemployment scheme, and other issues. So, yes, that's a bit also a factor who play a role in the outcome of the election. Hello?
All right, I muted myself. Now, on the tax issue, we all know that Ireland is one of the very aggressive countries, I mean, with aggressive policies on the tax side. Now, being the president of the Eurogroup, is this likely to make the voice of those in favor of some talk about fiscal dumping, but low taxes, and again for aggressive search for tax competitiveness, is this likely to make this voice weaker or stronger? Sorry if the question is naive, but sometimes we say, you know, being in the seat of the president, you have to be acting for the common good.
Yes. Well, I mean, first of all, the Eurogroup president, the role of the president is not as powerful as, for example, it could be the role of the president of the ECB or the president of the Commission. I mean, the role of the Eurogroup president is rather a coordinator. So he, let's say, agreed on the agenda together with the rest of the ministers, but he's a bit of the spokesperson of the group. He's a bit of the public face. He's a bit of let's say, the figure to try to, let's say, bring together the different inputs of the Eurozone members. But that also gives you some power, let's say, to slow down some proposals, to push forward some initiatives, depending on also what you perceive that it's necessary. So yes, I mean, it's not a super powerful post, but it gives you some influence. But in terms of tax matters, of course, I mean, having a country who is very much, I mean, perceived as a semi tax, heaven. I mean, if we look at the tax regime in Ireland, which is the corporate tax, it's average 12%. We know the tax rulings that they have, for example, with Apple, where they pay almost no taxes, and some other issues. I mean, this is gonna, of course, it's a blow for those who are campaigning against tax erosion and tax evasion in Europe. But anyway, I mean, the biggest obstacle to progress on these matters is not the fact that Donoghue is gonna be Eurogroup president. It's the fact that for tax matters, the EU, not the Eurozone, is the EU as a whole, had to agree at unanimity level. So as long as one country or two countries are against a proposal, that will kill the whole process. And that's why, I mean, any reform, any initiative on tax matters has been always like, fighting an Herculean battle. and the progress has been so slow. But if something is clear, is that, I mean, we saw how those countries, I mean, again, I mean, the vote is secret, but everything indicates that those countries who have more like a tax regime, which was not very, let's say, strict, or those who with loopholes for companies rally behind Donoghue. And interestingly enough, it was a question mark for many for diplomats and for officials how Malta was going to vote. We know that Malta is also part of this group, but the finance minister is a socialist, and it's a southern country, so his vote should have been very clearly for Calviño, but because of the tax issues, maybe we don't know if whether he voted for Donoghue.
Yeah, this is about secret voting, of course. So we're never quite certain how the members of the Eurogroup behaved. Now, what do you think can we expect for the European summit, which is to take place in a week on the 17th and 18th of July, and following the yesterday's election in the Eurogroup, even though you said it's a junior circle as compared to ECFIN, of course.
Yes, actually, I mean, the European Council President Charles Michel is presenting right now at this very moment the nego box, the proposal to try to bridge the different positions among the member states. So we will have to see. I will have to see what it's on in the proposal. But I think that his attempt was to basically keep the Commission proposal of 500 billion grants, and 250 billion in loans, and then try to play with. A bit lower MFF for the next 7-year period, and then in order to ease the northern countries' opposition, he was ready to maintain the rebates, this money that they get back because of smaller contributions.
Returns.
Exactly, returns. But yes, I mean, I will have to have a proper look to comment. But I mean, all in all, I mean, it's going to be a very, very, very difficult debate and negotiation next week. Everybody is already warning that the summit is going to be very complex. Merkel, when she was visiting the European Parliament this week, she said that everybody will have to compromise, including the European Parliament, and we don't know whether it will be possible to have an agreement before for the summer break. So that means during this month. But let's see.
Now, this is next week will be the last European summit, the first for the German presidency of the Council. When is the next European Council? We're sort of trying to catch up with deadlines and emergencies, of course. The next European Council will be in September, right? So that's rather tight. Everything is very tight.
Yes, I mean, not the proper, I mean, maybe I'm missing something, but the summits, let's say the official ones, the next one should be in October. I mean, there could be always a possibility of a, scheduling last minute summit, either in late August, either in September, in order to, let's say, to finalize all the details, because we need to recall that even if there is a political agreement, that's not the end of the process. Then national parliaments and the European Parliament have to ratify that agreement. That's why it's so important to have a political agreement as soon as possible, because that will leave enough time to have everything in place and everything ratified ahead of the entry into force of the new EU budget in January 2021. And at the same time, the recovery funds could start flowing at least no later than early next year, because, I mean, of course, the money is badly needed in many countries and many regions right now. I mean, not in 2022. And actually, countries like Italy were asking for a bridge financing to have some fundings already now. And that's also part of the proposal. But the negotiation is so complex that even, I mean, I don't know if that bridge financing is going to be possible to agree on. And we have to recall as well that, yes, the goal was by September. I mean, so I think it's going to be very, very, very difficult. And we have to recall as well that these negotiations are coming at the same time of the Brexit talks, which are going not that well. And that creates additional uncertainty, and that creates also it's very time demanding and energy consuming. And the result, or the rather the non result of that, could be further economic and financial turbulences in January 2021 if there is no agreement. And on top of that, there is the risk of a second wave of the coronavirus crisis during this autumn. I mean, given how continuous at the peak of cases and outbreaks, you could say that this is probably like a first wave beast, because, I mean, what we saw is like an stabilization period, but then the outbreaks are coming out. So, I mean, we have to see how the next months are gonna evolve. But hopefully, this momentum that was there and it existed when Macron and Merkel came forward, this 500 billion euros could be maintained, because at that moment there was a way that Europe will really be up to the task this time around, and they will have a massive response to this crisis, which is actually the deepest recession in almost a century. So, I mean, let's see.
So massive action and urgent decision making are really needed. And as we know, our governance is not very, very quick, generally talking. We take a lot of time, and hopefully we don't take as much time as was needed in 2010. We will be all ears to what happens next week, and maybe we'll listen to your observations and comments, since you follow all these events directly before the end of July and before the month of August.
Very good.
Thank you.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye then.
Bye.
Bye-bye.